This podcast is for alcoholics that have a willingness to recover from their alcoholism by being taught and practicing the principles of the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book and the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ilya, and I am an alcoholic. Page XIII, forward to first edition, first paragraph. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Page 68 of the Big Book, How It Works, fourth full paragraph towards the bottom. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man to flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? All right, so he's literally, Bill Wilson, is talking about sex itself. Sexual intercourse is where this is leading, and what kind is right, what kind is wrong, is the institution of marriage right, is having multiple partners right, the idea that we're not supposed to have any sex at all. We get all these different opinions and ideas from all these different people, all these sets of voices that cry out how things should be, and opinions running to extremes, as Bill says. So he also makes it clear that after he explains all the extremes, that we don't want to promote any opinion in this book. So we see here on the top of 69, we want to stay out of this controversy. So Bill's not telling us, or this program is not telling us, how much sex or how much too little sex is appropriate. What kind of sex, whatever it is that you are sexually, is not a judging mint or judgment that this book is trying to enforce, which is very reassuring. Like I said, I mean, if you have a sponsor who's telling you how to live, you better find a new sponsor, because that's not what this book is telling you either. It's not telling you how to live. Your need for control, your need for security, and your need for sex is between you and your higher power, not between you and your sponsor. And your sponsor, another human being, can't dictate to you how to live. And if they are, they're playing God. Because if God's the only force, or your higher power is the only force that can balance and temper your instincts, then who is your sponsor to tell you how to live and how to balance them? Or any other human being. So we stay out of that as opinionative people, and we don't tell our sponsees how to live. Now, we can make recommendations. It's recommended that you stay out of a relationship your first year. Maybe sex isn't involved in the relationship. Maybe it is. But doesn't mean that it says it in the big book. Nowhere in the big book does it say no relationships for the first year. I recommend that you don't, because you're going through a huge metamorphosis in life, in thinking and habit, and maybe the person that you're attracted to now won't be the person you're attracted to later, sexually and ideally. So, it's all a matter of having to go through that experience yourself, but I can't prevent you from having that experience because I don't think it's good, or it's been my experience that it's not good. So Bill's making it clear that we're talking literally about physical sex here. So we'll move on to the next paragraph, and he's going to bring up that extra character defect in the next paragraph that wasn't on the prior page, which is page 67, okay, where he talked about where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. That's the fourth column. So now he's going to write, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? So he added inconsiderate there. Fear is not there. Frightened's not there anymore. We just did an inventory on fear itself, so he didn't write that one in. Next question he writes is, whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So that first full paragraph on 69 is short, but it's a considerable amount of inventory questions, and it's also another inventory in itself. So we have the sex inventory, and he's also introducing a fourth category. Whom had we hurt? Okay. Now, I don't necessarily have had to have sex with somebody to hurt somebody in a relationship. I didn't have to have sex with somebody to unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness. All right, so those are outcomes of a poisoned relationship. If I'm selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, and fearful, then I'm going to take action that's going to arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness over the course of that relationship. I may believe that my spouse is a possession. Alcoholics tend to think that things belong to them, even people. And so if I think that she is on a coffee date with another man, when she's just at a business meeting, I'm overly suspicious. And if she is having a coffee date with another man on a business call, then I'm jealous of that suspicion, as a result of that suspicion. Now we can take it to another level and say, oh man, she is really, really, cheated on me. So this is my wife, and I'm gonna go kill the guy that did that. Instead of blaming myself and why she needed to feel the need to cheat, I'm focused on the guy that she cheated with. And that can lead to a resentment. And somebody is with her and she's my possession What do you think an insane alcoholic is going to do? He's going to hurt people. Whom had we hurt, right? Is a part of that. So these emotions can this is where we start to hurt people. With jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, that's when people start getting hurt. So relationships are the last of the inventories because they're the ones that where other people are involved. Resentment and in fear, we're looking at ourselves, but now we're looking at how ourselves affected other people. So the next question is, where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So he's back to that physical act of paper. He mentions paper, okay, on every single inventory. If you read this, how it works, as he goes through resentments, fears, sex, and harms to others, he reminds us that each one of these has to be on paper. So when you break out this section of the book, you can see that creating these spreadsheets for those four separate categories are all in here. They're not just made up by alcoholics who decided to create another program. This is in the literature, and the spreadsheets just make it easy for the newcomer to get it all on paper, the correct way that it's outlined in the literature. So the spreadsheets could have just as easily been in this book, but instead they're buried in the paragraphs. So when I upload the resentment and the fear, the sex and the harms to others inventory, they're just titled at the top differently, but all four columns are the same. Who it was, what institution, principle, or person, for resentment, what fear do I have in the fear inventory, the name of the relationship I was involved in the sex inventory. And in the harms to other inventory, it's who did I harm? So that'll help you when you have that harm inventory. All these inventories will help you when you get to the eighth step and you make a list of all individuals you've harmed. You'll have some of it done in your fourth step because there's people who are immediately top of mind that you can think of. So it just makes it even easier when you get to the eighth step. You don't have the list completely finished, but you're more aware of your faults and whether or not you need to proceed with making an amend with them. And we're not there yet, but that's why you don't burn these inventories after you admit them to your sponsor or another human being, because you need them. They're your research. So how could you burn them? It's a ritual that serves no point whatsoever, and nor is it in the book. Doesn't never says in here to burn your inventory after you admit it. It's not magic we're dealing with here. We're dealing with real life information that you're going to need to understand yourself after you write it down, and it takes you, you need it to clean up the record of your past. So we got this all down on paper and looked at it. So it's the same process. I've discussed it in the prior podcasts. I'll upload the sex inventory and the harms to other inventory to the Dropbox, and you can print them out and start filling them out. Now remember, you want to fill them out vertically, not horizontally. It's easier to think of all the people, think of all the resentments, think of all the fears, because your mind is focused on just a list at first, and then you can go through the cause and write down all the causes vertically, and then you can write, your what you think, what instinct was under threat by checking the box, and writing down why you think. Let's say if you think it's material security that was under threat, write in the margin or write on another piece of paper why you think that was the instinct that was out of under threat. And then same thing for the defect of character. When you check a box, you need to keep in mind, write down why you think that your part was selfishness, for example. It's just not a word. You have to explain, why you think it was selfishness. And so then when you get to the fifth step and you go through each line item with your sponsor, you'll be able to get to the truth because your thinking may not be correct. That's why we have to do this with another person. Not the fourth step, but the fifth step. Reread it to the other person for their point of view on what it is that you your part was, your defect was. And so the point of that will come later. We're not on step five yet, but you can see how the fourth step leads right into five. And we'll get through your fears because I know you have them on admitting this to another person, because there's going to be things on that list that you probably thought you were going to take to the grave, but we'll get there in a moment. So next paragraph, page 69, second full paragraph. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex partners were God-given, sex powers were God-given and therefore good. Therefore, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. So we're really trying to get to, first, we have a selfish disease and we have to know, was this, did I do this because I wanted my instincts satisfied, or was I in this relationship because I care about others? So, that's the first question we have to ask. What was the motive of the relationship? And if our ideals are self-centered, which they is the default position of any alcoholic, we need God's help to mold them into how He would have us be. And that our, sex pa he calls them sex powers. These are powers given by God, right? God given. And all our instincts, all our base instincts are God given. But if we use them too lightly or selfishly, we're either despising our God-given instincts or loathing them, in this case, sex. So nowhere does it say that we're not supposed to have any sex at all, or a selfish kind of sex. And the solution is not to not have any. Selfish, therefore I won't have any participation in my instincts, is also selfish, because you're not sharing yourself with another human being. You've created a wall around yourself, and therefore you're selfish because you're not allowing other people in. So it can go to either extreme. Remember, this is a disease of extremes, not about eliminating sex entirely or being a multiple partner sociopath sexually either. So what you need to do is just take the list and ask yourself, with your sponsor, because this is something you'll do in your fifth step, where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Or where was I inconsiderate? So Bill's setting us up for what's to come on how we try to understand our sex inventory. Now, sex is also relationships. Remember, sex just doesn't include intercourse. It's talking about, our relations with other human beings. You can almost call it a relationship inventory. There are people on my sex inventory list, in my experience, that I never even had sex with. They were relationships that had gone really bad as a result of my selfish behavior. And I wanted to have sex with some of them, which meant that sex was involved because it was an ambition. There's a sex amb Remember, there's an ambition category on the third column. It's not just what's under threat, it's what am I not getting that I want? What's my motive? And so that means that if sex is my motive and I'm not getting it, it doesn't mean that sex isn't involved in the inventory. So if I have a relationship with a friend who I am interested in, I could be very dishonest to try to get them into bed, even though I've never actually had sex with them. So that's just one example. So just remember, it's about relationships more so than intercourse. And that makes it a lot easier. Because I was sitting back and I was like, oh, well, no, I didn't have sex with them, so they don't go on the list. But there was a lot of desire there, and there was a lot of manipulation. And they certainly belonged on that list when you look at the rest of the paragraph that Bill has us read after his explanation that we don't talk about, or judge how people's sex lives or people's sex preferences. That's between you and your higher power. So now we'll move on to the third full paragraph on page 69 toward the bottom. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. So now Bill's introducing further steps in the program. We're on step four, but now he's talking about the willingness to make amends, which is step eight. And then he's talking about nine, provided that we don't harm anyone in making the amend, which is listed in nine. So there's eight and nine right there. We've worked on, we're going to do six and seven prior to that, because if we're not willing to change, right? Change is in the prior paragraph. How am I going to, and with God's help, remove those defects? Why would I make amends with anybody if I'm still blocked with my selfishness, dishonesty, and consideration? Of course, I wouldn't make amends. And if I'm jumping to making amends, then I still have the motive of trying to get something in return or manipulate an outcome. So that we cannot do until we do four through nine. And then the last sentence is in meditation. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter. So now that I'm unblocked from my higher power in four through nine, I have the ability to meditate and ask God for help. Now, I still may need to meditate before I make the amend for information on what to do, but we also need to get some help from another person before we make that amend. So it says here, in the next paragraph, God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. So if we're working the program, having some counsel from another human being is desirable. He's not saying don't talk to anyone else about it. Just make sure that the person you're talking to is practicing and understands these steps. That was my experience because I will get hysterical thinking or advice from other people, and they'll tell me exactly what I need to do, and then I'll run out and do it, but they're the one who's coming up with the solution, aren't they? It says here that we let God be the final judge. All right, so other people's opinions and the way they live may not be good for me. So you have to try to grasp that what may be good for other people may not be good for you. So if somebody has a balanced sex life and they're able to manage their emotions, by having more than one partner, and you disagree with that, that's okay for you to disagree with that, but it doesn't mean that they're living incorrectly. If they're not being dishonest, selfish, and fearful and inconsiderate of others, they can have any kind of sex life they want. That's between them and their higher power. So for us to judge how other people should live is in our, we're in our self-will, we're in our ego. So remember, if we go back to the beginning of How It Works on page 60, it says at the bottom in the last paragraph, on that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. So now we're in collision with another person, even though my motive may be good to tell them how to live and what kind of sex life they should have. I'm still in my self-will. Their sex life and your sex life are between you and your higher powers. And if I want to give my opinion, I should state that that's my opinion. But if they don't take my advice, I shouldn't be disturbed by that. And if I'm trying to manipulate them into my will by doing things the way I think that sex should be morally handled, then I'm in my will, and I'm going to create confusion more than harmony. And go back to that ego-centric, egomaniac thinking. And sex is a very powerful instinct. That's why Bill leaves it to last in the inventory section, because it's the most, emotional. It creates the most emotions when you bring other people. People drink at other people. They have resentments at other people. And most of these things are imaginary, or not that big of a deal. But when you have relationships with other people, then you start to believe that, they're your world and everything matters or hinges on this relationship. And that's when these emotions can start really, really running wild. So we do the other two inventories first so we can see our part and who we really are, and then we can, take a look at how that has affected our relationships. So the best thing I can help you with here is to understand this isn't just about sex, it's about relationships. So now let's read the next paragraph on page 70. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But this is only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe that we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to get drunk. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. So back to, what is your motives? Are you just manipulating people to basically have more sex or to control others? If that's what you're doing, in all likelihood, you're going to create such havoc and confusion in and have an emotional upheaval that you're going to need to numb that pain by drinking. So he's saying right there at the end that this has been our experience. We're not theorizing. Maybe you will go out and get drunk. No, you will go out and get drunk. And you will be, right back in your disease with alcohol in it. So what we have to understand is, do we have a willingness to be better people when it comes to dealing with other people? If we're not sorry and we have a vengeful thought towards somebody and we're going to get revenge on them, even though we're pretending to work this program, it's not going to work. Our motives have to change through the inside out. And if they don't, and we're just doing this for forgiveness so we can continue to be the same self will jerks that we always have been, then we're going to go out and we're going to drink over it. So God doesn't, expect perfection again, is what he's saying. If we do our best, these are ideals, these are principles. If we go back to how it works and it talks about perfectionism, this is where we start to worry again. Oh, well, I'm not being perfect. My relationship's not perfect. There's still problems. So I might as well not do it at all. No, it's not stating that. We have to at least try. We have to be what? Page 60. In the first full paragraph, it says, willing to grow along spiritual lines. And no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. So we're not saying that you have to be perfect, but you need to be willing to grow along spiritual lines. And if you can't be other-centered, you're never going to be God-centered. So the first thing we are is self-centered, and we're trying to become other-centered in our relationship, where it's not just all about us and our God-given instincts being taken to extremes. And then we basically are other-centered. We care about other people. We don't let them walk all over us, but we are concerned about how our defects are affecting other people. And so once we understand that and we try to change our relationships, then we can, and I didn't say change other people. I said change ourselves so our relationships can change. Changing other people is impossible. They are who they are. So one of the things that we need to understand, and I'm glad I thought of this, is that, you know, if we think because we're changing, they have to change, we're sorely mistaken. We're back in our will again. Other people are who they are, and accepting other people for what and who they are is one of the most difficult components of acceptance in this program. And if somebody is harming me over and over again, and I'm trying to change them, the only thing that I can do is get out of that relationship. Now, I may not want to get out of that relationship because I'm attached to them, but I can't change them. And if they continue to harm me, it's my fault. It's not theirs at that point. So don't think that just for a second that just because you're changing means that they are too. They may not want to. And that's one of the reasons why it may not be a good idea to have a relationship for the first year, just because you're changing and you're going through a lot and there's habits that you're trying to break along with understanding your disease. And if you're in a relationship that, was part of your drinking life, maybe you don't want that relationship in your recovered life. I don't know. All I'm saying is that relationships can trigger defects very quickly. And if you can't control your own inner nature before you're in a relationship or decide to stay in one, it can be dangerous. And again, he says, we're not theorizing. These are our facts out of experience. If we don't have the willingness to go into our relationships with our motives being in God's will, there we are. So you must be an expert if you can do that, but I certainly couldn't. So next on page 70, second full paragraph, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge. When to yield would mean heartache. So now Bill's talking about helping others. A relationship is about two people helping each other. It's not just about satisfying each one's individual base instincts. If you do that, eventually you arouse jealousy, bitterness, and suspicion. There's no way around it. So the Bill is introducing the power of prayer here. You know, we pray for God's help. What is the right ideal here? I don't know. You know, I'm willing to remove these defects and change. So what can I do to be more sane and have the strength, right? That's in step 11. What is God's will for us and the power to carry that out? We are now sound of mind because we have asked for God's help to restore us to sanity. So that's step 2. So now we're in a situation where Bill is talking about step 11. And if we're still troubled, the best thing that we can do for ourselves is go out and help another alcoholic or help another human being. We try to get out of our own minds because we can obsess over these relationships. And when we obsess and we isolate and we sit around thinking about them all the time, trying to figure it out, it can drive us crazy. Once we pray and meditate, it's not going to be necessarily a quick fix like alcohol or drug or any other addiction. It's going to be a slow fix. And so you have to trust that, you know, once you've prayed and meditated on this relationship that you're having difficulty with, that God over a period of time will come in your life and give you the peace and serenity. And in the meantime, You're going to have to go out and get your mind out of your mind. And that's the best thing you can do is go to a meeting, for example, and carry the message and help another alcoholic. That's why meetings are good, because now you're not there for the purpose of what you can get out of a meeting and taking from a meeting. It's now what can you give to a meeting? And that changes your whole dynamic and your thinking. And that brings you a spiritual experience, because you are now there for the purpose of not taking, but giving. And so these are ways in which we, pass the time until the right ideal comes, and when God's ready to give you the solution to the dilemma that you're in. All right, so let's read the next paragraph, on page 70, third paragraph, full paragraph. If we have been thorough, there's that word thorough again, about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. So there's that last category again. We've listed the people we have hurt. So there's four inventories: resentment, fear, sex, and who we've hurt. So once we come to the conclusion of this exercise, we've written down quite a lot. It's not a casual 5-minute list, and a frothy conversation with your sponsor. It's a very analytical process, and each inventory line item is documented. Okay, you can't remember all of that in a conversation with your sponsor unless you have a record of this inventory in your hands on paper, those spreadsheets that I uploaded. Need to be completed and filled out, and now you're ready to go and admit this to another human being. So now that we've analyzed and resent our resentments, our fears, our sex inventory, and our harms to others, we see the patterns. We see the futility and the fatality of it. We have commenced to see the destructiveness. This is recognition of pattern. And when you have that aha moment of, wow, I really am the problem here. Look at the damage that my ego causes. There's actually great relief in that, because now you know that there can be something done about it. Because if you're not the problem and something else is, then you're doomed. So now that you know that you're the problem and why, or getting to know why, you have the ability to do something about it. And that's continue with the rest of the program. That's what you do. It's always the steps. The next right thing is the step. So instead of trying to conjure up what the next right thing to do is and how to fix it, think of it as, if I just do the steps, that information will flow through me and I'll know exactly how to handle it. And that's what God's will is, not the will of another person telling you how to live or what to do. So we start to see that, patience, tolerance, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, we don't hate them as much. We see that these other attributes of tolerance, patience are coming out in us. And if we can be sick and feel better, and become more unblocked, then so can they. And we understand that they're just blocked. So we can have compassion for somebody who's been where we are, and now that we're healing, we can see that, wow, they just are really insane and delusional, like me, or like I was. Because when you start working this program, you may have the capacity to be insane, but you're not insane when you're in the solution. So when you're not insane in the solution, you have automatically have compassion for other people that are not in the solution, that are in their disease. And so that's not something that you can, believe me, you have to experience that yourself. Just hope that you would trust that I'm explaining the directions well enough for you to practice and try this yourself. That's all I can do. Let's help you understand it better, as it relates to the reading. So we see that we've hurt other people. Now we're going to read the next last paragraph and how it works. Bottom of the page, last full paragraph. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. There's that word blocked again. Okay, your self-will is your instincts that are blocking you from God. Next sentence. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. So now that we know that we're blocked and we've made a decision, what's the decision? Step three, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So now we are, you know, into the work. We're into the fourth step. We've made this decision and now we have the inventory. We're following through with it. Of our grosser handicaps, the main things, the main resentments, the main fears, the main sex, and the main harms to others. We have a list of that. But it's a good beginning, all right? It's not the final end-all and be-all. You've done a lot of good work. You've digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. But there's still more to do. When someone says this is a beginning, to assume that it's the end is incorrect and delusional. So the book is telling us that this is just the start. And then when we get into the action, we're going to be moving into the fifth step, which, you know, fourth step is an action step. But now we're going to actually bring another human being into this inventory process. And that takes a little more courage. So we have to have a whole conversation and a whole separate step about what the fifth step entails and why we need to do it. So hopefully up until this point, you've at least, you know, listened to all the different inventories and what we're trying to accomplish and where the spreadsheets are in the Dropbox and what another diagram on the Dropbox is the different parts of self-will, which is the need for society, the need for security, and the need for sex, and the different subcategories of each of those three base instincts. And so you can look at that when you're writing out your inventory and say, oh yeah, no, that it's not just society, it's prestige within society that was under attack. Or it was, you know, my hidden sex life as opposed to my accepted sex life. Hidden meaning that you don't want anyone to know about it, but it's still an ambition, even though you don't want others to know about it. And then there's your accepted sex life, which is, for example, you know, your wife. You know, everybody knows this is my wife. This is who I have sex with and a marriage with. Doesn't matter who knows that. Okay, so, but you still have ambitions for either one, and they both involve sex. So there's different categories or subcategories within the three main instincts, okay? Pull the spreadsheet off Dropbox, and you'll see what I'm talking about. We also learned that a resentment is an incorrect judgment as a result of my threatened instinct. A fear is ultimately an incorrect behavior, okay? So I'm in fear of my instinct that's under threat, so I behave in a fearful manner. And then as a result of that, it leads to harms to others, okay? So a resentment is incorrect judgment. A behavior is an incorrect fear. And an incorrect behavior, and then an incorrect action will result in harms to others. So three-prong thinking, behaving, and doing. Thinking, behaving, and doing. So with the inventory, it helps me see that how my thinking, my behaving, and doing is creating turmoil and can lead me to a destructive life, if not a fatal one. And this can happen without alcohol. It's just that when it becomes too crazy, it's too much for my emotions to handle. And my emotions need a drink or a quick fix in order to numb the pain. And if you let this disease progress too much, you may not think you're a quote-unquote low-bottom drunk, but you will get to be one. And there's no need to go through the extra 15 or 20 years of the ringer, as the book says, to get out of this thing before your disease takes you down to that bottom floor in the elevator, because there's still another floor below that and below that and below that, and then you're dead. So there are people who still have, two cars in the garage, a seemingly nice home, and a job. But if you are an emotional wreck and your life is unmanageable internally, you're ready to do this program. It makes no difference if you want to be the brown paper bag with a trench coat walking in the city, living under a bridge, stumbling around the city's alley streets, and that's your interpretation of how I'll do this if that happens. Well, you're well on your way, buddy. because I was on my way. I actually probably wouldn't have made it that far. I would have ended up wrapped around a telephone pole the way that I drank. But either way, the outcome is the same. So it doesn't matter how you drank. If you drank on the couch and weren't out and about, blacked out, committing crimes, doesn't matter. I mean, you can still identify with this disease, whether you could, not harm others as far as you think you were, just physically drink yourself to death, or drink yourself into a blackout and commit a crime. Either way, you still have this disease. It doesn't matter the type of drinking that you did or the effect it had on you compared to another alcoholic. It just means the outcome is the same. We're still all in the same, we still all end up in the same place emotionally. We're both in the same place. So, comparing yourself to the way somebody else drinks or doesn't drink, or their, reaction to alcohol makes no difference. You put down the bottle. If you're not identifying with these extremes in your personal emotional nature, then you can probably work another program and you can get sober by doing something else. This program, again, is designed for the chronic alcoholic only, not the hard drinker, not the moderate drinker, not somebody who drank over some bad luck for a few years and then put it down and got on with their lives. They may have gotten a psychiatrist and don't drink anymore because they choose not to. Good for them. They are not an alcoholic like you and I. So, when you wonder what's the point of doing these inventories, nobody else has to. Why should I? Well, because these steps are designed specifically for one type of alcoholic only. And if you found that you are that alcoholic in step one and you can't fix it, and you believe now only a higher power can, and now you've made a decision to turn your thinking and your actions to that higher power, the next logical step in this process is to take an inventory of your thinking and your actions. And this is the very method in which Bill figured out how to do that. And that comes from, the psychiatry part of the program, the middle part of the program. No human power can restore you to sanity, but you still have to look at yourself. So there is a human element involved in recovery because you are a human being, and so are other people. So, in order to have a relationship with other human beings, we have to understand human nature and how an alcoholic's human-based instincts are out of whack. We have a missing chip in our minds that does not regulate. If you've ever heard of the governor, there's no governor in our mind when it comes to the tempered and balanced instincts that most people have. And that is what separates us from a non-alcoholic. And anyone whose instincts are out of control and in survival mode over the littlest things and the smallest ambitions all the time can be nothing but insane. And alcohol is the only thing that can fix that, numb it, give you temporary relief. And when you have alcohol and that relief runs out, then you're right back where you started, if not worse. And then the physical allergy kicks in. And you have no control whatsoever on what you ingest in your body. And you'll die from a physical complication instead. And your brain is physical as well. So you can have a wet brain if you drink too much, and then you're completely mentally retarded, if you will, as a result of the alcohol intake you've taken to the point where your brain is damaged, literally brain damaged. So better to get out sooner than later, but unless you've hit an emotional bottom, you're most likely going to continue to drink, let alone do these inventories or fix it your way, one of the three. But we're here at the end. I hope you understand the inventory process a little bit more. You can always email me if you have questions. And again, the reading on step four is in what I covered here and how it works, and also the third column of this inventory process is explained in detail between pages 42 and 54. So that's 12 pages of the third column, because that was the hardest column for me to understand. Why were my instincts out of control? What is it that I needed, power, money, and sex related, that was causing me to behave in this manner? If I don't accept that part of the program, that instincts out of whack is self-will run riot, again, the rest of the program does not work. So here we are at the end of another podcast. God bless and good luck with your inventories. We'll get into step five on the next sessions. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.